Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal, which aims to make sense of our COVID-19 world today and tomorrow. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi, researcher, author, and speaker from Brand Positive. As a researcher, I've spent 20 years conducting ethnographic interviews on global projects. Along the way, I've been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom I'll be talking to in this series. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, empathy, and privacy, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, looked into innovation, behavioural change, and the climate crisis. So, I hope you enjoy the interviews, and if so, please tell your friends, leave a rating, and watch out for our other episodes. Now, without further delay, let's crack on with today's podcast. So today I'm really interested to be talking with an incredibly dynamic individual, Taji Chezemet. Taji is a legislative intern for Representative Akasha Lawrence Spence in Oregon. He's the co-founder and executive director of Raising Justice, of which obviously more in a minute. He's been an intern at ACLU, as in the American Civil Liberties Union. He is a BMA project lead in the city of Portland, BMA being the Black Male Achievement Organization. And he's also doing currently a BA in International Global Studies at the University of Chicago. So an incredibly dynamic individual doing some really, really important work as we are now in autumn-ish 2020. So I want to hear about all of that. So Taji, I know you're over in Portland, Oregon. So how are you today?
Oh, I'm doing quite well. It has been a very interesting last week, and just now recently dealing with the new slate of fires, just compounding these great issues happening across Oregon and the country, and I mean across the world as well. Just hanging in there, doing as much as best as I can.
Yeah. I know when we were talking earlier on, you're mentioning about how odd it is looking out your window and just not what one would normally expect to see in terms of just a really odd sort of midday twilight, which I have to say is the same sort of thing that my friend Gareth Cave sent me a shot looking out of his window in San Francisco. Just really, really eerie and odd. But yeah, one of those. And actually, as we speak, in terms of all things involved with the climate emergency and all the rest of it, the ever wonderful, powerful, dynamic Extinction Rebellion. Big shout out to them, who are currently involved hugely, as always, in raising awareness of that and encouraging and really, really pushing for meaningful change. Mm-hmm. But Taji, so tell me about, first of all, Raising Justice, because I spoke with someone a month or so ago about this. And as I understood it, Raising Justice has just been going through a bit of a reposition, a name change. So I wanted to hear about that. But also, I just really, really, it'd be great for you to give us a really detailed talk through exactly what Raising Justice is all about, what you do with the organization, and all the rest of it. So yeah, I'm really, really interested to hear about it, because it's obviously massively important, to put it very, very mildly. So Taji, over to you.
Yeah. Well, Raising Justice, it was formerly known as Youth Educating Police. We're an organization that was started when I was around 15 years old, along with my other friend, Britton Masbeck, who's the operations director. We co-founded Youth Educating Police, really with a lot of statistics and information and honestly conversation in the community around what does policing look like and how are young people involved in the process of sort of improving those relationships. And that was a really, I would say, juvenile understanding. We had a lot of interesting feedback from the community coming into that conversation as young people, as this sort of space has, and this topic of policing has been quite prevalent. I could trace it back to like the 1990s when it was really starting to talk after the war on drugs and whatnot in America. And Yep. I think what was most interesting in the beginning of the organization was a lot of the support that adults and specifically police had in the work that we did. It was sort of unprecedented to see young people so invested in trying to improve a very untapped area, which was this like youth development and really getting to the root that young people are developmentally different than adults and that there has to be a specific cadence and compassion to interacting with young people. That was not something police officers were ever trained to do. It differs a lot from something like implicit bias, which is a very talked about idea around police reform. And since then, we were able to actually pilot our training, which was a hybrid model of in-person and lectured video format, not because of COVID, just it was conveniently worked out that way. And it provided a really interesting perspective to the officers of the Portland Police Bureau here in Portland, Oregon. And from there, honestly, about 3 months after into quarantine lockdown time, we approached an individual by the name of Joe, and she really wanted to help us and believed in our work and found that, you know, this was also post the incident with George Floyd being murdered by police as well. So really a large conversation happening from the community, from leadership in the country about what do we do. And so Joe really had a specific soft spot to our work and really wanted to find a way to help us. And at that same time, we connected with an individual you were able to interview a month ago, Jen, who is the director of Sparrow Strategy. And together with Sparrow, with Joe, with some really awesome just collaborators, we basically were like, we want a new website for sure. We don't think our website really gets to what our organization is now. And it's really a response to the community because that's who we work for, really. But at the same time, it was a response to us knowing that our work was in a complacent space, really, like not really recognizing that there's so much dynamic pieces to understanding policing. And so, you know, we jumped, you know, headfirst into what does it look like to rebrand as an organization? And that started with wanting to change the website, obviously, and really went all the way to the point where we changed our name. And it was an uncomfortable but necessary process. And it was quite an experience to go through at the infant age of 3 for our organization.
Sure.
Glad to do it now rather than later down the road where it could hamstring us or anything like that. Raising Justice really is an organization that challenges this idea of systemic oppression that young people specifically face in the criminal justice system, working to create some of those safer communities for young people and really understanding that young people's public safety is something often denied. If you're talking about the school-to-prison pipeline, if you're talking about access to social services for specifically families and communities of color, all of these things are specifically, I would say, designed, and a lot of folks say broken, but I don't think they were ever meant to help young people or meant to help those who are marginalized. And recognizing that at the core of our work has really shaped raising justice and wanting to really, you know, understand what does justice mean? What does it mean to want to look at a decentralized approach to reaching young people and getting them to understand that, you know, their voice matters and that they don't have to just be living in the status quo of things and sort of become complacent to police officer killings or, you know, excessive use of force with young people. These are things that should not happen and the state should not have the ability to, you know, purport this idea of community policing and this idea of doing their training bias stuff and getting more cops of color or whatever. And then it's still happening, right? So it's really a more integral, you know, at the root systemic issue that can't be just addressed through simple things. And that's where Raising Justice recognized that issue and recognized our position to change that.
And tell me about the reception that it had then, certainly when you started it, in terms of literally how you got going and who you spoke with, how the community reacted, how institutions reacted. Just talk us through that.
Yeah, well, ironically enough, the organization was started in 2017, but the conversations as young people really began in 2016 through the format of a forum called Police Peace PDX, which provided a space for community members, law enforcement, and folks just working in the criminal justice echelon to come together and talk about what is policing? How is policing affecting the community? What does it look like to improve those relationships? But also, what does it look like to improve the outcomes that are happening, which is, you know, murder and violence, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, those conversations were actually not ones I was involved in 2016. And prior to the founding of the organization, I had my fair share of interactions and exposure to policing the criminal justice or the juvenile justice system, and a lot of exposure just from where I lived, from the types of schools I went to, the types of individuals that I associated with at a younger age. And as I, you know, moved into high school and got more involved in things like Black Male Achievement and the Multnomah Youth Commission, it's a policy body in the Portland area. I really understood that there's a distinctive nature of social justice that was calling on young people to use their voice in a way that past generations, I would argue, have not sort of really digesting a lot of information. I would give that to social media for why that happened. And that, coupled with a long investment I was beginning to have in the power of dialogue, led to, you know, Youth Educating Police. And I met Britt through Multnomah Youth Commission, and we were, you know, first and foremost friends, obviously. And from that, sort of stumbled upon this, you know, beautiful idea of what can it look like to address things from these two completely different perspectives, mine from my own exposure and experience with policing, and then from Britt's exposure and experience with dialogue and conversation, and connecting those two became, you know, perfect pairing.
And again, in terms of how this was then, you know, how you really got energy into the organization, into the movement, and how it began to, if you like, sort of gather force. So perhaps just talk about that, because, you know, naturally the idea of having a great idea, an important idea, an important concept is, despite the fact that it's really important and valid, obviously most people who try to do things like this don't get anywhere, but, yeah. But you obviously have.
Right.
So again, for those who may be listening, who want to think, you know, so what was the magic ingredient, or was there a sort of a lucky break, or was there someone in particular that lent you a helping hand, or opened a door, or what? When looking back only the last couple of years, are there any, say, people or bits, places in time, etc., that you think, right, that's when it really clicked, and that's when we actually began to really get some energy behind this, or get some publicity or whatever it was?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that, you know, the conversations were the foundation, the jumping off point for knowing that there was a problem. And I think the stats also back that up. And I think that was really important in us understanding the importance of, you know, starting the work. But you're right. I mean, anyone can start anything, and it's not going to pick traction up, or, you know, entrepreneurship is a didactic and complicated field.
Sure.
And so, you know, I came from a background, and I think Britt also came from a background in just the work that we were doing prior to starting YEP, that we had passion that exceeded that of just pure interest. And we took that, and I think when people saw that, we didn't say, oh, we have passion and we love this work, please help us. But I think they felt and saw that. And I think the individuals that, you know, showed that support were, ironically enough, some of the police officers who were like, wow, there really is an issue. You have this niche. And I think that was another piece, is like, we had this, you know, specific goal and outcome we were looking for that was very, you know, seldom talked about in the larger conversation of policing reform. And we wanted to chip away at one specific issue as opposed to being like, we're going to be youth educating police and we're going to end police violence. And when we have succeeded, there'll be no more police shootings in this country. And sure, yeah, that's great. That's a great end all be all goal. But we were like, I don't know if it's, I would say we came with a lot more pragmatism and we were a lot more aware of previous work related to, I mean, the Black Lives Matter movement and the NAACP and even the ACLU. A lot of groups, you know, starting, I believe, in 2014, that really wanted to address this issue, and taking information and notes from them organically or indirectly became a great, you know, beginning information and resource for us as we did our work. And so a lot of the passion and a lot of the sort of principled nature of Brent and myself became what led us to where we are today. I don't think it would have been possible to, you know, do what we did if it wasn't for the amount of passion, amount of time and energy we put into it. And I think, you know, that's a specific thing that a lot of young people are grappling with now, and I've been grappling with for a while. I think there's since 2016, post Trump being elected, there was a large slate of youth activism, and I feel like it became something that businesses and organizations capitalized on and made a specific type of activist that was, you know, the Greta Thunbergs or the March for Our Lives heads or those individuals that got a lot of traction on media for their work, rightfully so in some spaces and others I'm more critical of. But I mean, all that to say, like, there was a lot of activism work specifically from young people being called on. And I was a little pejorative to that idea because I do the work I do, not just because it's trendy or because, and I would say the same thing for Brit, not just because we do what we do, not because it's trendy or because it's, you know, going to get us into college or whatever, but because we recognize an issue, we recognize we have a niche solution to the issue, and we recognize we have this passion and a principled nature to approaching it. And then, you know, sharing that mission to other individuals has led to our larger team. And Brent and I did lead a lot of the work, I guess, directly for the first few years. And then, you know, just this during quarantine, using the power of the digital space, have been able to collaborate with the great group of individuals from folks that are literally in Minneapolis, where George Floyd was murdered, all the way to individuals in Washington, D.C. and in Arizona and New York. And it's just been a great experience getting more folks engaged with our work. And I feel like it's been, you know, it's that investment of those who community members that has made me so impassioned to continue doing this work.
And then what about, I'm looking at your site in terms of either brands that have got involved or organizations that have got involved. Mm-hmm. Have you had much help there? Has the help, if they have given it, has it been sort of, you know, sort of co-branding, almost, to say help or whatever, or has it been sort of, you know, financial help or advisory help or what?
Yeah, I think there's a very interesting thing around money, and I think that especially in regards to nonprofits, a lot of folks have a very rightful critique of the nonprofit industrial complex with in relation to money, in relation to corporations and whatnot. And we're at Raising Justice, we're very cognizant of that specific dialogue and try to take it with a grain of salt, really. I think that all of the funders of our organization as of now have been grants that we've applied for, whether locally or nationally. And we, you know, during this rebranding have recognized, along with some of our board members helping us, the importance of diversifying funding, because it really is not, you know, it's a nonprofit. We're not doing this work out of pursuit of money, and we're not selling anything, really. What we are is a collective, a decentralized group of young people trying to fight a specific issue around public safety. And when we get the buy-in from the community, whether it's, you know, I mean, literally with financially or through their time, you know, like someone like Joe or Sparrow Strategy, really, that is important for then the individuals who we want to work with, whether it's city governments or police bureaus or other community organizations, showing that, okay, this group or these young people have a principled approach to this issue, have investment from the community in the value of their mission and in the value of their programs and the value of their outcomes. Mm. So that's sort of why, how we look at, you know, funding in relation to the work that we do. And we really also try to, you know, step away from like focusing on, you know, being in the forefront of the issue, saying we have the only solution or saying we have the end all be all as a way of showing that there is a lot of obviously growth for our organization, but there's also just a lot of individuals working in this area that I don't think we have the final solution to any of this at all. But we have a mission and we have a passion and we have young people who want to see change. And we address that wholeheartedly in the programs that we operate with.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely fascinating. Just moving onto one of the other things that you're very involved in, which I realize totally they all, if you like, sort of dovetail. But perhaps just tell us about the activity you've been doing with the ACLU and exactly what they're about.
So yeah, the American Civil Liberties Union started in
long time ago,
100 years, I believe. I first got involved with them, I believe in 2017, I want to say. This is ironically enough the time when YEP was starting, Raising Justice was starting back then. YEP. Where I did a book club with them just around like Oregon's racial history. And from there, I got the opportunity to actually introduce Angela Davis at their Liberty Dinner, which is their yearly gala, which was like a whole new world for me. And from there, I sort of just stayed in contact. And at one point was like, what is the viability of, you know, being an intern with your office? A little more context on that is, my high school, De La Salle North Catholic High School, we are part of a national network called the Cristo Rey Network, which basically for Catholic schools across the country basically employs students one day out of the week and allows them to work in an internship. And so I was plugging that a program through my school. I was like, do you think we can maybe, you know, make this work? And so they were like, that sounds so cool, because they were very familiar with, I guess, you know, me in my energetic approach to the issues that we were talking about in the book club, and also, you know, just working with me during the time when I was introducing Angela or Dr. Davis probably. You know, they were very receptive to it, and specifically the development department, which was a interesting area to work in, I would say, fundraising topic. So I also had the opportunity to do policy work with them. So I focused in development and policy, and it was an experience like no other, and I was given a wealth of knowledge on, I think, one of the largest, if not the largest, litigation nonprofits in the country.
Whoa, nice.
So I was very humbled to take part in that.
Yeah.
To be able to, you know, help in one way or another. That was, and I do the work of that, and I do the work with the Representative Lawrence Spence and with BMA, really because I love learning and I love the work of all of those respective organizations, entities, people, and I find it to be helpful in my future, whether it's just simply, you know, public speaking, communication, or something more in depth like coordination and community organizing. Just there's so many fun ways to learn. I feel like I've tried to find myself diversifying the sort of engagement I do with different work, whether they BMA, Representative Lawrence Spence's office.
And then what about the BMA work you do? So the Black Male Achievement in Portland. So go on.
That was my first, I guess, approach into the city politic climate, so to say. I got involved, ironically enough, because my mom was a former commissioner on the Portland Commission on Disability. And from that, I got connected to CJ Robinson, who's the director of the Black Male Achievement Program. Works out of the Office of Equity and Human Rights, which is a bureau in the city of Portland. So it's a very unique program specifically because it's funded by the city. So it's, they don't need to like, you know, they don't, they're not a nonprofit in any way, shape or form. So they're, you know, just an investment of the city, which is great. And it's a program that really fosters a connection with young Black men and trying to improve the mental, physical, and economic and emotional, I believe, health of the Black male community. And so when I first was connected with CJ, I was like, I really love community events and I love programs and I love organizing those sorts of things. And he was like, great. And so I, at 14 years old, as a freshman in high school, got the opportunity to like coordinate 20 or so young Black men and doing a project that I was sort of leading or overseeing.
Fantastic.
It was a really fun experience, you know, just as a freshman. I think before that, my only exposure to that type of work was in student council in middle school. So really a step up from that, getting the opportunity to, you know, coordinate, connect, and bring together community members across the city, and connecting with, and the focus of the first year was on mentorship specifically. The title was No Role Models. So it was focused on a lack of mentorship in the Black community.
Yeah.
And that was a really fun opportunity. And we did it again the year after that. And we did, I believe it was Black owned business and Black space. And that was really fun as well. And I also got to coordinate that one.
Okay, so on that exact point, I mean, because I know that the BMA looks into improving life outcomes across education, employment, family stability, and criminal justice. But that issue that you mentioned just now about these specific couple of things you worked on, so no role models. So what sort of thing would be done then? You know, what would you talk with people about, and what sort of role models would you be portraying or describing or highlighting?
Right. I mean, ironically enough, CJ and the other person who helped run the program entirely, like the cohort of young Black men, was Walter Robinson. And those two individuals became role models of mine, ironically through BMA. And so, you know, during the planning of the event, we were like really looking at, you know, what does a lack of mentorship in the Black community mean, and what are the repercussions? And as we approached that question, we sort of just looked at some of the gaps, and not gaps that we necessarily could put the onus on the state or the social services, but it's really about relationships, community, and connecting, and about a lack of that being present, at least in a city like Portland, where there's not a lot of resources and opportunities for the Black community in collecting and coexisting, as there are in other more predominantly Black cities, whether you think Oakland.
Yeah.
So it was really about addressing that issue. And it was around, and then it connected me to my own mentors who provided invaluable, experience, knowledge, and wisdom to me as I continued down my path of leadership, as you may call it.
And then Black on business.
Yeah, that was a fun year, because we didn't just go with that topic. Part of my job as the lead was to bring together a sort of analyzing larger systemic and cultural issues in the Black community. And I came up with the main ones. It was Black-owned businesses. I think we were going to do a second iteration of maybe Black mentorship. And I think the other one was around uplifting Black women, I want to say. And so we ended up choosing Black business and Black space, as we saw they sort of connected, but also related to a larger issue in Portland around gentrification, which is this idea of like placement. And it's very prevalent in Oregon, or specifically Portland, just as it's become a larger national city and more folks are migrating here as they're enticed by our vegan restaurants and urbanization.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the that was why we were focusing on that topic, really wanting to address how do we still hold value in our community when we're so disconnected, literally and metaphorically. And so it was a really awesome opportunity. We brought multiple Black-owned businesses, I believe Black restaurants specifically, and we had a lot of music and performances by Black artists. And it was just a really awesome, it was in the end a community event, like a block party of sort. And it was just amazing experience to take part
in. Yeah. It just sounds incredibly inspiring and incredibly practical and all the rest of it. So extraordinary. And then what about your activity with Representative Akasha Lawrence Spence? Because over here, I'm not familiar with her being based in Brighton, England. So perhaps I've checked her out online. I mean, she sounds super dynamic, to put it mildly. Yeah. But go on then. For those of us who aren't familiar with her, go on then. Give us a
Representative Akasha Lawrence Spence was actually one of the she's the sixth Black legislator in Oregon specifically. So she's an Oregon House representative, and she actually wasn't elected by her constituent. The former legislator who had the district she oversees, or I don't know, represents actually, was, I believe, either retired or there was a scandal. And she was appointed to that position. So it was a different situation. She actually began, I believe, the beginning of this year and sort of just jumped headfirst into an insanely important district because she represents downtown Portland and some of Southwest Portland, I believe. And so I began working with her in the context of a zine that I was working on with her office. I was connected to by one of her staff members. I work with a group of other young people addressing, wanting to address, it was post George Floyd as well. It was in Brown June we began connecting. And then she had the opportunity, she offered up the opportunity to do an internship, and I applied to do it, mostly because I think she knew of me and my work as we worked together on the zine, obviously, but also just in my other contexts. And I think she wanted to have individuals who could really help lead some more community engagement efforts for her office. And I've been really excited being able to do that. So I've already sort of now taken on the role of overseeing the advocacy group she's hosting. We've been meeting weekly for about 2 months now. We just put out our zine called Hear Our Voice PDX. You can check it out on hearourvoicepdx.com. I say I plug it there, right? But it's really not a money thing. It's not we get clicks or anything. It's really an awareness thing. It really tries to aggregate a large amount of information around what's happening in Portland into a 6-page, well-crafted zine. That was, really awesome and fun experience for me. Definitely new in the sense of community organizing, and was definitely interesting to take part in. So yeah, that was how I got connected to her. And once again, one of those opportunities that I really just have loved absorbing information and learning new things. And I've been having a lot of fun doing that through all of the different work I've been able to take part in.
Absolutely fantastic. But meanwhile, I mean, it has to be said, I mean, again, from this side of the Atlantic, over in England, I mean, all the things you've been talking about just sound incredibly dynamic, real social action taking place, really well thought through, and obviously making things happen, which is, obviously sort of deeply, deeply impressive, but to put it mildly. But meanwhile, is all this just not being sort of steamrolled by all the other activity that's taking place in Portland from the point of view of what's on the news? So, I mean, for the last, let's say, at least 6 months in terms of the international news, Portland to us just looks like a battleground. Now, I don't know if that's the day-to-day reality that you're seeing as you sort of, as you walk around Portland, and if the media is either exaggerating it or focusing on one specific thing and to the exclusion of all else. But just talk about the sort of the reality of Portland as you see it, as you're wandering around, as it relates to the, say, to the media version of it, which seems to be now being put in a position whereby it's absolutely center stage, particularly as we go towards the presidential election, which is very, very soon. It seems to me almost deliberately just, singled out as being, right, let's use Portland as the, almost as a sort of petri dish to see just how far we can push people. I mean, is that Is that the reality of it, or is that sort of a media exaggeration or what?
No, I mean, there's media is media, and I think that it's going to be exaggerated for clicks, and that's what they have to do to make money. And I'm not going to, you know, hint them for that. It's a reality. And so one of the most interesting conversations I've been able to take part in is while I sit on the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing, which is a, Portland had a settlement agreement, on about in 2015 around use of force against folks experiencing mental health crises. And, one of the agreements that the city, it's weird because it's like an entire city, you know, representing themselves in a Department of Justice court case. But the city's, one of the settlement points was that they had to have a body that was responsible to oversee the community's perspective on policing. And so I sit on that body and have the opportunity to have a lot of interesting conversations around what's happening now in the country. I mean, the body existed for about 2 years now. And so, you know, post George Floyd, and I believe we're over, or I mean, we're definitely over 100 days protesting now. There's been a insane amount of information and conversation and media and violence from all sides of the city and of the state, wanting to point out specifically that we're looking at an issue that was not rooted specifically in the murder of George Floyd, and that the issue of police violence, of systemic racism and white supremacy was very much not a thing that started on May 27th. Individuals were at a compounded point in and around June, looking at the global pandemic that is then hitting Oregon worse and worse as we go on, the nature of the houseless situation in Oregon that was not remedied by our city leadership during the course of the last 4 years. And so, you know, on top of that, the unrest around the police in Portland, I mean, it has its fair share. It's not the worst police force in the whole country. It's not the one you look at as the one that needs every fix or whatever it may be. So, you know, if you look at like the eight can't wait site, we meet six of the eight, so we must be good, right? I mean, it's not that, but what it really is that the individuals in Portland are, I mean, it's talked about as a liberal safe haven in a lot of ways, and I think that's what's been the biggest limelight it's faced. But to that point, a lot of individuals recognize the power of free speech and the power of organizing in the way that we have. And I think that it's an issue of the, it's a Black Lives Matter movement, yes, but it's really about about policing. And I think what a lot of media has done is, you know, worked under this guise that it's protests and really ignored or, you know, relegated the actual root issue to the side for the sake of clicks or the audiences, right? And so, you know, being in that space has been quite interesting, especially being an 18-year-old who began doing this work 4 years ago, right when the new mayor started, right when Trump got elected. It's been a fascinating opportunity to really understand the ineptitude of politics and why I find myself not wanting to get involved in it more and more by the day. But, you know, back to the point where I have seen the mayor state that he is extremely against violence and does not condone it and will denounce those actions, and then writes things about how police are using violence, and then will then go on to say, you know, don't use violence, I will denounce that. Like, it's very contradicting language that's rooted in a poor leadership of the mayor, and that's a critique I'll continue to say until the election and we see if there's a new mayor. And you know, Portland is a symptom of a larger issue of police violence, and I think that we have definitely provided a large, you know, space for discourse, whether literally in the space of protests or in conversations and dialogue that have occurred. And I mean, I could talk on and on about my thoughts on this. And I think really just to summarize that we, as an organization and as an individual, I really stand with the movement and stand with this idea that until we are seeing the action that the community wants, there isn't going to be a normal thing where you can just, you know, move along and drag your feet. And we're going to hold our electeds accountable to the reality of unarmed Black people being killed at the hand of state violence, whether violence in the sense of a police officer shooting an individual, or in the state of, you know, there's Black trans individuals who've died in Portland who have not been killed by police, but have been, their cases have been completely ignored in the larger scheme of justice. And it's just, once again, a larger symptom of complacency, of leadership wanting to drag their feet and not actually listen and work for their communities and work for the interests of profit or for the interests of the businesses that fund them. And it's not how I personally see politics, how I think politics should work. And I mean, it can parallel my outlook on Boris Johnson in Britain as well. So
okay, so what about, I mean, you talked a lot about naturally, you know, the power of community, the vitalness of community in terms of sort of social stability and all the rest of it, and giving people a foundation, and about sort of, you know, helping people to be resilient or to build resilience, particularly around things like the sort of BMA, etc. What about, I mean, in terms of, again, stepping back from the whole thing, I mean, all of these podcasts I've tended to link into the sort of the term I use, the new abnormal. I put there sort of, you know, hope, community and resilience being the three things that I certainly talk about a lot. I mean, could I just ask, it might be quite a sort of a crude push, but I mean, in terms of, if we've spoken about resilience and community a lot, what about hope? I mean, what gives you hope as you look forward? I mean, do you have hope? Yeah, talk a bit about that.
No, I have not.
Links into you. yeah.
I definitely do. I think if I didn't, I don't know how I would get up every morning doing the work that I do. Because I think that, you know, as I and many other young people work to disrupt the status quo that is the bureaucracy of America and politics here in Oregon specifically, I recognize that this is what the community wants, and that is where I find my hope. I find my hope in the individuals who hold space for, you know, uplifting and empowering youth and uplifting and empowering communities of color, and specifically Black and Indigenous communities. And I think that when the community is finding hope in some of the darkest times in our country and in our city, that's where I, you know, feed off of that energy and work 10 times harder. And I know that, you know, I've taken part in my fair share of the protests, and I've organized my own as well, and find the importance of it essential. And as I can't make every protest every day, I show up in every Zoom room as I can, right? As I do my work, working to change these things. And when I have conversations with folks like the district attorney, and he's telling me that the newly elected district attorney, and he's telling me how much inspiration he has in the sort of mission of our organization, the mission of our work, as well as this idea that we need to change these systems, and then telling me like actionable things he wants to do to change that, and the power he does to actually do it is very hopeful. You know, I find hope in those smaller situations where I'm like hearing adults, folks with power, the gatekeepers, so to say, open a window, so to say. They may not open the whole door, but they're opening a window and making spaces to not only have conversations, but show up and change things for the better. It might not be as fast as everyone wants it, or that I want it specifically. But you know, I'm faced with working in that system, and the system's definitely slow paced for sure. And so that's where I find probably the most amount of my hope. I also find it in my team and in new individuals that I get to conversate with, like yourselves, who find inspiration and in learning more about this issue. And even if it's not in the context of your country directly, I would say. But yeah.
Yeah, but we have, believe me, many of exactly the same problems we've had. Again, I say recently, I spoke with one of the podcasts with Wim Baptiste, and so we talked a lot there, as have actually many others, about the issues of, you know, police violence here, issues about black youth and minority youth issues. And believe me, many of exactly the same issues, unfortunately, are very, very much prevalent over here. Can I just go back just and I'm aware sort of time is beginning to get against us now, but it's been such an interesting conversation. What about the issue of, for yourself, when did you find people taking you seriously? And I say that in quite a deliberate way, because I say, because certainly it's obviously being aware you're 18, you know, again, come back to this point about loads of young people with fantastic ideas either aren't taken seriously, or people treat them in a very sort of condescending way, or things just don't fall right for them, don't work out. You seem sort of, you know, super dynamic. I keep using the same word, but when did you find people actually began to listen to what you were saying and take it in, as opposed to just nodding politely?
Right. Fun topic, specifically around, I guess, like this idea of my perspective as a young person being taken seriously, but in specifically the context of like, listening and wanting to respond and wanting to not just give me some, bureaucratic answer, but some candid response around, you know, something that they recognize as an issue. And I think that's most relevant in the context of talking with, folks very high up, who, I guess sort of say they recognize this issue. And then when I sort of say, okay, great, I'm glad you recognize the issue, I'm glad we're on the same page here, what are we going to do about it? And wanting to look at politicians as not this, omnipotent individual who has no responsibility or need to respond to the community in a meaningful and impactful way is BS, in my opinion. I think that when I've testified in front of city council and I look up and see the city council like stood up, that's when I know what I'm saying is meaningful and has some sort of impact, whether it's negative or positive, on how they're going to continue to go about doing their work. And knowing that, I'm not just a 25-year-old community member who just graduated, undergrad and, got a degree in criminal justice, and I'm now going to go tell people what to do. I'm saying that I don't need a fancy degree or a title or anything to know that you should be working in pursuit of my interests, in pursuit of the interests of the community, and not doing that is antithetical to your mission and why you were elected or why you are put in that position, because it is not always just elected officials.
Powerfully put. Nice. So Tasha, just tell me, so the listeners are all crystal clear about where they can either track you down and or where they can find out more about the various organizations you've been talking about. Perhaps just give us a bit of that so where people can
find out more. For sure. We have, for Raising Justice, we have a website, raisingjustice.org, and we have social media, Raising Justice on Instagram, and then We Raise Justice on all the other ones. And personally, it's just my first and last name. I'm not a huge like poster, but if you're interested in connecting and talking more about stuff, I'd love to talk with individuals about, I mean, like yourself, Sean, but also, you know, anyone who's interested in, I had an interesting conversation this past weekend at a community event while I was passing out the zine with this mother who was like asking about how do I get my daughter to not just show up to a protest back in June, but really want to find herself engaged, and she's anxious or worried about doing it, or feels like she doesn't have the experience to do it. And I suggested to her to really just, you know, take those sort of uncomfortable steps of reaching out. And once you do, you'll find that you've met a community of individuals who want to help you cultivate and build your own leadership and skill set. So yeah, definitely reach out and definitely willing to talk with individuals about their work or their interest in work with whatever topic.
Very good. And so, like, this last couple of questions. So, what's next on the horizon for you? Are you working on any particular project at the moment? You know, specifically within the whole issue of raising justice, or what? And yeah. So, what are you up to right now? What's coming up fairly soon?
Well, yeah, directly working right now. We have a large project related to zero youth detention. Focused on a roadmap, similar to King County, which is in Washington, right above Oregon. And they passed a roadmap on zero youth detention. How do we stop holding youth to the same standards we do adults and actually work in rehabilitation? And so we're doing that same sort of beginning field work right now. And that's quite exciting and fascinating to work on. Personally, I'm going off to University of Chicago in a couple of weeks, which is pretty exciting. We have fascinating transition to adopt that plus what I'm doing now. And yeah, that's pretty much what I'm up to these days.
As we said, Chicago, obvious point, but Barack Obama's old town. So there we go. Nice. Yeah. Very good. Well, look, Itachi, it's been absolutely fascinating talking with you. Obviously, I'll put the links on the notes for the podcast so people can track you down. I'm sure they certainly will. It's been really, really interesting talking with you. So thank you so much for sparing me the time. So Taji Chesimet, the Executive Director of Raising Justice and a soon-to-be freshman at University of Chicago, thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Sean. It's great hearing about this work and how you want to highlight these spaces. And I'm very excited to be here and talk with you today.
Thanks for listening to the New Abnormal podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Please leave a rating, tell your friends, and until next time, goodbye.